The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to London's South Bank. It's bathed in brilliant September sunshine, the trains are rumbling past, and I'm here to meet the ninth incumbent of A Room for London as she exits from her four-day stay on a boat perched on top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall. She is Adaf Swaif, the Egyptian novelist and commentator who sprang to prominence with her Booker shortlisted novel The Map of Love back in 1999. She's since become a leading figure in PALFEST, the pioneering literary festival based on the West Bank, and her most recent book was a portrait of her home city, Cairo. Like all the writers who've been interned in A Room for London, she was tasked with writing an essay about Conrad, Rivers, London, any or all of these things. So, Adaf, tell us what you've been thinking about.
Well, my thoughts varied, really. They varied with the weather, obviously, and with the length of the stay and sort of feeling the isolation, and also with reading what my predecessors had written. So my mood kind of went up and down. But always, I mean, whenever I look at the Thames, I think of the Nile. I mean, I don't know whether that's kind of permissible or chauvinist or natural or what. And so, yeah, I mean, my reflections kind of took in both countries.
Your task in your 4 days was to write about London, rivers, Joseph Conrad, any or all of those things. And here you are on one river, having just left another river. And of course, the Heart of Darkness is about a third river, the River Congo. Tell us about what rivers mean to you.
Many months ago, Archangel and The Guardian approached me to do this residency here on the boat on the South Bank. And I was really intrigued by the idea and agreed to it. And then a few months later, my younger son was looking for an apartment and he came home and said he'd found a boat. And it was really a bit of a joke, but I went with him and we looked at the boat and I was very taken with the idea. It was a boat, you know, on a stretch of river near Battersea. And in an unreal way, I was very taken with the idea of living on that. And I remembered that I'd always had a dream of living on a houseboat in Egypt, drifting up and down the Nile. And actually, I think I might have found a houseboat in Egypt and I might be about to acquire it. And so, I don't know, boats. It seems that this year is the year of boats for me.
Thank you very much. And now let's hear your essay.
One. Behind my left shoulder, the giant wheel of the London Eye. Behind my right, the Wedgwood Pastel of St. Paul's. Turn left, turn right, and in the space between the turns, the panorama of London passes before me. The Palace of Westminster and Big Ben with the Tower of the Abbey rising behind them. Whitehall, Charing Cross Station, the building I've always thought of as the Daily Mail, the Savoy, Somerset House, and on to St. Paul's. Icon after icon, like toys laid out in the window of a souvenir shop. I have lived in and out of London for over 30 years, and I have seen this view countless times before, not from this exact same angle, but from the pavement below, or from the various terraces of the South Bank Centre, or from the bridges, or, well, today it's different. Today, I'm sitting cross-legged on an enormous bed, phones, laptop, diary, books around me, mug of tea at my side, at home. Temporarily. And today, it strikes home in a new way. I am in London. Today, my first day here, everything is in headlines. In the failing light, a seagull wheels past my window. A boat hoots on the river, the note foggy, even though the light is clear. The aircraft in the sky are so much smaller, more frail, than the oddly static pods of the eye. I climb out onto the deck, and I see pyramids, the wire pyramids holding up Charing Cross Bridge, reflected upside down on the face of the station. Below me there are parasols, people, the bookstalls in front of the NFT packing up, lights coming on. Whenever I'm near the National Film Theatre, my father's with me. I keep my membership for his sake, even though he's 88 and unlikely to want to travel from Cairo to catch a movie. He first brought me here, there. Down there, when I was 5. This is where I started to love cinema. And over there, across the river, where the lights have just flickered on, is where he took me to listen to the bands in bright uniforms. Were they military? I don't remember. And I don't remember paying particular attention to the obelisk over there. We had bigger ones at home. And there, at that point which I can't quite see, just west of Embankment Station, is where we all met on that morning of 2003. My mother and me and Ricky, my younger son, and Sheila and Bridget and Alan, and the Bloomsbury crowd and the Guardian crowd, and we started on the march. The march against the Iraq War that was to change nothing and change so much. I watched the scenery change to party time. The National Theatre's a flaming pink, and Aldwych peeps out in purple from behind the staid white of the National Archives. Why is it possible to feel instantly at home on a boat in a way that's difficult in a hotel, impossible in a just-moved-into house? The transient self becomes one with the transient boat, perhaps? Yet this boat is far from transient. This boat is berthed, perched, here, on top of a concert hall, looking out on the city, waiting. When I go to bed, I don't pull down the blinds. Surrounded by light, I fall asleep to the pops and creaks and thumps that I have, in a few hours, come to know and ignore. In the night, the alarm goes off 3 times. The first time, I wonder if I should get out of bed. After the second, I can't sleep. The third finds me reading the words of my predecessors, the other writers who slept in this bed, stood on the deck, watched the flow of water and traffic, contemplated the river, the city. 2. They invoke my predecessors, as you would expect, past writings, and parents, and issues of belonging to this city, this civilization, and Conrad, always Conrad, since the conceit is that this boat we've all lived on is his boat, the Roi de Belge. Did Conrad belong here, or didn't he? He made his name in English, yet he writes of a man dying in the middle of his family, speaking sadly in a language no one could understand. Well, I'm no Conrad, but I've always been puzzled when asked about belonging. How English do I feel, I'm asked, and the answer is, not at all, but I feel comfortable. It seemed to me that the available labels are wrong, that what is being asked is the wrong question. Was Conrad racist? For me, it was clear when I read him that he expressed racist attitudes, and it was also clear that he was a brilliant writer. And I was glad when I found that Edward Said had dealt with all that, as I thought, once and for all. What seems more pertinent, I sit and think, is to look at those attitudes for how they manifest today. When Marlowe, in that famous paragraph, ruminates, "The conquest of the earth is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea only, an idea at the back of it, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can set up and bow down before and offer a sacrifice to." Well, the idea, idol, he's set up, has not gone away with the collapse of the old empires. Call the idea development, call it capitalism or the free market, call it even democracy along Western lines. The idea is the same idea, generated in the West and pushed on the rest of the world for its own good. But the idea doesn't just murder people in Afghanistan and Iraq. It doesn't just try to appropriate the revolution in Egypt. It decimates the citizens of its own countries. Jack London wrote 100 years ago of the disposable underclass in this city, the underclass that agrees to its own periodic culling. Across the Atlantic a few days ago, a man who would be America's next president said that 47% of his co-citizens did not concern him. And in Egypt today, after police had killed 2 more men, the people of Midramr marched with banners proclaiming, "The men you killed were workers." In other words, we do not consent to the cull. It's late. Fairuz Karawiya's voice flows round me. "Have you tried waking alone? Walking alone, though the streets are full of people?" To my right, Waterloo, and to my left, Charing Cross. Bridges and terminals, and into and out of them, people walk. In that alley by the station, My first love brought me to a secret bar. At that point by the obelisk, I set a scene in my first novel. The obelisk and the kitchen towel by this sink, right here, are both made in Egypt. And so is Fairuz Karawiya's voice that fills my, for the moment, my boat. I stand at the kitchen window. Above the Royal Festival Hall, rising out of it, tall and slender, is a bullet pointed at the sky. A ring ascends it, and hanging from the ring are chairs, far-flung, whirling. They fly and whirl and circle for a few minutes. You can see people's legs dangling. Imagine their hands gripping the ropes. Are they laughing, screaming, or just keeping a grip? A brief moment, and the ring begins its downward slide. And next to it, dominating the view, the aerated wheel of the London Eye, held together by what looks like string. A giant circle punctuated by pods peopled with tiny little dolls. You cannot see it turn, but focus on an individual pod, and each time you look, it will be in a different place. Its motion is perpetual, imperceptible. It's late. My mother, in her last year, had clocks hung on the walls in her living room and her bedroom. In the hall, she wanted time to be no more than a glance away. My Aunt Awatef's husband, in his last few months, kept demanding what the time was. He'd yell from his room and bring his wife hurrying down the long corridor. "Awatef, what's the time?" It drove her mad. "What appointments do you have?" she'd eventually shout back. "What is it you'll be late for?" Edward Said, at the end, insisted something had gone wrong with his watch. Tonight, I have two massive clocks to consult. The Daily Mail's in front of me, flanked by the Union Jack and the Stars and Stripes. Big Ben on my left. It doesn't need to fly a flag. In Parliament, they're discussing again how to make public spending cuts and avoid raising taxes. The rain begins. What flood is this boat waiting for? 3. At the kitchen counter, I consider making tea. In the great solid bulk of the Royal Festival Hall, there's a cut-out rectangle of a window. I guess from the height and stance of the people in the foreground that they're sitting at a bar. Others move behind them. In that rectangular frame, they seem to be theatrical, choreographed, performing. Then I realize that's the members' bar where I had sat back in the summer, looking at this boat. I had seemed normal to myself then. Then the boat was the surreal spectacle, sitting like a giant brown flightless bird, incongruous on the grey concrete. I had looked to see if anyone was in there, in the window where I am now, looked to see what performance this person was putting on. I stand as still as I can. If someone looks over from the members' bar, maybe they'll think I'm unreal, a cutout, a prop. 4. Rain. Always when I try to contemplate the Thames, I end up thinking about the Nile, a river that works by simply existing and plants life in a desert, a river on which a queen set sail with her musicians in a boat hung with silk to meet the man with whom she would take on Rome and fail and break wide a schism between south and north forevermore. Here, there's no music, no purple sails. Only the raindrops clinging to the window panes and the gulls wheeling in the distance, and it will never stop raining. It will always be grey. I will never get out of here. My face on the octagonal table. It would make perfect sense to die here, with the grey rain lashing at the windows, screening the grey river, the grey city. The sound of the rain beating down upon this boat, the only water this boat will ever know. Grey puddles on grey gravel, grey river, grey city. I shall die here. 5. We have a meeting of the board of the Palestine Festival of Literature, PALFEST. I don't die because I remember we have this meeting and I have to prepare the papers and make lunch. After my friends have exclaimed over the view, we celebrate that we took PALFEST to Gaza for the first time this year. We resolve to hold the festival next year in Jerusalem, in Gaza, Nablus, Ramallah, Hebron, Bethlehem and Nazareth, somehow. During the meeting, a phone call from Cairo, Ash-Shuruq newspaper is adopting a campaign to stop the displacement of the poor from the heart of the city. Can I write 3,000 words? And just downstairs, 10 days ago, in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, people from this country and many others gathered to talk about the Arab revolutions, about the need for change everywhere, and to rock to music from Tahrir. And I remember, back in 56, our flat in Stockwell, filled with friends, English friends, as well as Egyptian and Indian and Syrian and German. And I remember the anger and the laughter and the flags and the marches, and my mother explaining that our English friends were angry because England had attacked Egypt. Shall we rephrase those questions then? Those questions about belonging?
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.